Beasley Boston, hosted by George Knight. Public affairs programming on Beasley Media Group stations in Boston.
February is Black History Month. It's a great time to celebrate positive things, the rich history of African Americans and the Black experience, the role that African Americans have played in moving our country forward. It's also a good time to take a look at the things that we're not so proud of as a country and to make an honest assessment of where we stand when it comes to issues of race. We have the pleasure of speaking now with Dr. Philippe Copeland. Dr. Copeland is clinical associate professor at the Boston University School of Social Work, faculty lead in education and training at the BU Center for Anti-Racist Research, and faculty affiliate at the Center for Innovation in Social Science. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Copeland. I very much appreciate it.
Great to be back.
I want to talk this time around about racism denial, and you had a very interesting piece in the Boston Globe that talked about that, and so I'd like to go over the points you made, and we will certainly get into specifics, but I thought it would be helpful to start by having you just give a general explanation of what you mean when you say racism denial.
Yeah, so when I use the phrase racism denial, I'm referring to efforts to try to obscure the reality of racism or to try to minimize its significance and impact in society, not just in the United States, but really around the world.
We're going to get into the why it exists, but can you talk a little bit? I know you talk about how some people benefit from racist denial, and perhaps that's why it's perpetuated. Can you talk a little bit further about what you mean by that, why someone would benefit from it?
Sure. So one of the things that we know from history and also from social science and research is that there are real differences in the quality of life of different groups of people, depending upon the racial group that you fall into.
Yep.
Generally speaking, not just in the United States, but really worldwide, if you happen to belong to the so-called white race, as people call it, overall, your quality of life across multiple measures is going to be better than people who don't belong to that group historically. So there are these gaps, right? And so if you're in the group that benefits from the way that the world is currently sort of organized, you have an interest in keeping that going. You have an interest in making sure that the problem of racism does not get solved. So some white people, not all white people, they're very much aware of this. They've actually worked very hard to achieve a higher status relative to other groups of people. And so they're deeply invested in keeping that in place. So when they engage in racism denial, I talk about it as being strategic. They know that racism is a problem,
yep,
but they don't want to solve it because it works for them.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean when I talk about it in terms of a political strategy for some white people.
You also talk about how it can be used as a coping tool. And I wonder if you could talk about in what ways racism denial could be used as a coping mechanism.
Yeah, that's a great question. So for some people, particularly folks living in what we understand to be sort of Western democracies often, you know, they live in societies that preach equality, but often practice the opposite. And so in order to function in a society like that, to some degree, you have to deny the reality that you see every day. You have to deny the contradictions, because to face them honestly and courageously, for some people, causes a lot of distress, a lot of dis-ease, a certain degree of disorientation, to ask hard and difficult questions that many people don't want to deal with, including about themselves.
Yeah.
And so for some people, the pain of those contradictions is so great that it's easier to simply deny reality. And so they use racism denial as a kind of coping mechanism or a coping strategy. So you have a political strategy, but you also have a coping strategy. And you don't have to be white to use that coping strategy. Many people who are directly affected by racism also, to some degree, try to find ways to cope with it. And one way is to try to deny the extent of it, the depth of it, the power of it.
We're speaking with Dr. Philippe Copeland, who is clinical associate professor at the Boston University School of Social Work, talking about racism denial. I want to go down some of the specific ways you mentioned in your great article of, you know, ways that racism denial shows itself. And for each, you know, if you could talk a bit about how each tactic is used and also what can be done in response. First of all, you talk about refuting. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, so refuting tends to be a very just clear, direct sort of denial or dismissal, either of racism as a problem generally or of the relevance of racism in particular situations. So when people are refuting, they're basically just saying, absolutely not. racism is not a problem, or in this situation, racism is not a problem. And often what will happen is that, for example, they'll use sort of cherry-picked pieces of information or data to make an argument to say, see, that wasn't racism, so you're wrong. Another thing that they'll sometimes do, if that doesn't work, is that they'll shift to making sort of accusations against people or groups of people. They'll say that you're playing the race card. They'll say that you're race baiting. And so those are the kind of things that refuters will often do, people who are using, engaging in refuting. They really want to shut down the conversation completely. And they want you to walk away from that experience not wanting to talk about it again because you've had such a negative experience with them, or you've been so sort of challenged or browbeaten or accused, et cetera, that you think twice about bringing it up in the future.
And that's happening in 2023.
Yes, jeez. Often.
Yeah. Oh, man. All right. Let's talk about minimizing. Can you explain further how minimizing is used?
Sure. So minimizing is often done by folks who are willing to acknowledge that racism is still a problem, or they're willing to acknowledge that racism was a factor in a particular situation that's being debated. But their position is to say, well, look, it's not that bad, right? Racism is happening, but it's not as bad as you're making it out to be. It's not as serious or as widespread as you're making it out to be. You're exaggerating, you're overreacting, you're making something about race. Another thing that's common to say now is that you're obsessed with race, right?
Yeah.
Which again is another kind of accusation, right? Like you're making it bigger than it is. Or if you think about it from a policy standpoint, you know, people will say, okay, yes, there's some racism, but it's really only sort of right wingers or extremists or white nationalists. It's not a common problem that requires, you know, actual policy intervention. It's just really, you know, sort of hardcore, conscious, committed racists. And most people don't fall into that category. So you're generalizing, right? Or you're exaggerating. So that's how it often looks, minimizing.
And what's an effective response when someone tries to minimize that?
Well, I think one helpful thing to do is to just provide people with accurate information that really provides a sense of the scale of the problem.
Yeah.
Right? Just how big it actually is, how many different kinds of people are affected, how deep the impact is, not just on, you know, particular communities of color, but really on the society that you live in, on world politics. Those are ways that can help some people to begin to see that it really is more significant than they think. And it's not just about, you know, sort of overt acts of, you know, discrimination, bigotry, or hatred by particular white people. It's a much deeper problem. We talk about it as being a systemic problem.
We're speaking with Dr. Philippe Copeland, clinical associate professor at the Boston University School of Social Work, talking about racism denial. Another thing you talk about is myopia, keeping the blinders on, I think. Can you talk about that, please?
Yeah. So myopia, a great example of myopia is, you know, people who say, I don't see race, right?
Right.
So when people engage in myopia, it really is a kind of, it's an unwillingness or an inability to actually perceive racism accurately. And, you know, the classic is, I don't see race. And often what happens is that the people who say that they don't see race, they also don't see racism when it's happening either. They have a tendency to misperceive the nature of certain kinds of dynamics or things that are going on in society. They'll often say, you know, why do you make everything about race?
Yeah, you know, right, yeah.
That's a common kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it really is a kind of, it's a misperception, or in some cases, a kind of willful blindness, a sort of turning away, a refusal to look at the truth, to look at the facts. And I refer to that as myopia. It's very short-sighted. And again, these are people who, they don't necessarily claim that racism isn't a problem at all, but they tend to not see it even when it's right in front of their face.
Not seeing the big picture kind of thing.
Absolutely. Sometimes a small picture too.
Yeah.
You know.
You talk about replacing and then, you know, kind of shifting the focus from the issue of racism to something else. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. Replacing is a strategy of changing the subjects. So I'll give you an example. Something that happens a lot, like when people try to talk about, let's say, racism and policing, a common response to that, well, is what about black on black crime? People do that a lot.
Yep.
Highly popular. And, you know, that's a great example of replacing. So the person doesn't want to have a conversation about a particular form of systemic racism or particular acts of racism that are being committed by individuals, let's say politicians. And so they'll just bring up something else. And, you know, what about black on black crime is very popular.
You talk about defending. Can we go down that alley a bit?
Sure. So defending is it's an effort to avoid accountability. Often defending is an individual trying to defend themselves from an accusation of racism or an effort to hold them accountable about something that they have done or said that other people see as racist. But sometimes it is an effort to defend their group, right? The group that they identify with.
Yeah.
So one thing that people will often say when they're defending is, well, you know, I can't be racist because some of my best friends are black, right?
Yeah.
Or some of my best friends are Chinese. Or, you know, how can I be racist? You know, I have people from that group in my family, right? And so often people who engage in defending, they're pretty well prepared. You know, they have all kinds of defenses ready to deflect from the accusation of racism or just the possibility that something that they've done or said might be racist. So it's a dodge. It's an effort to avoid accountability.
Similar tactic is excusing. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. Defending and excusing often go hand in hand. Excusing is often used on somebody else's behalf. So you're making excuses for someone else's behavior or another group or a nation or whatever, their behavior when people are saying, hey, that's racist. So for example, a common example of excusing is to say, well, listen, that was just humor. You know, you're taking it too seriously. I was just making a joke, right?
Yeah.
That's a great way of excusing, you know, engaging in racist behavior. Another form of excusing is to say, well, you know, this person can't help it because this is just how they were raised or they're from a particular kind of a generation. And so they can't help their racist behavior or their racist statements. That's another pretty common excuse that people make for people.
We're speaking with Dr. Philippe Copeland, clinical associate professor at the Boston University School of Social Work, talking about racism denial and the many ways it rears its head. You talk about revising history, and this is a biggie. Can we go down that a little bit, please?
Yeah, so revising history actually involves pretty much all of the things that I've already described, but it's just applied to discussions about the past, right? Or people's interpretation of the past or the ways in which we remember or make meaning of the past. And so you see all these things. You see refuting, you see replacing, you see myopia. So for example, you know, often people will talk about things like the Civil War. This is a classic example.
Yeah.
And there's a name for it, which is the lost cause, right? But they'll say, well, look, the Civil War was not about slavery. It was about states' rights. Classic, yeah. You know, racism denial, often as an effort to defend not just Confederates of the time, but really admiration for Confederates, the history and the heritage of sort of embracing racist politics, white supremacist politics. And really, and I often joke about this, you know, people have been lying about the Civil War since they lost it.
Yeah.
I mean, very quickly, right. People started trying to rewrite history about what the war was about. And anybody who does even, you know, very sort of modest research, you see very clearly that the lost cause is a myth and that the people who decided to secede from the Union and go to war, they were very clear that it was about preserving the institution of slavery. So if it was about states' rights, it was about states exercising their right to maintain slavery. That's what it was about.
As you're talking about this, I'm thinking about some of the crazy arguments for, you know, when Confederate flags are taken
Absolutely.
Down. Yeah. You know, oh, it's just about
Absolutely.
Pride of the South. Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's about everything other than, you know, the actual facts.
Yeah.
So it's defending, it's excusing, it's minimizing, So yeah, I mean, the debate about, you know, Confederate iconography in public life is just rife with people trying to revise history. Absolutely.
We're talking about racism denial with Dr. Philippe Copeland. You talk about distorting. And if we could go down that a bit, please.
Yeah. So distorting, I think, is one of the most egregious versions or forms that racism denial comes in. And it really is an effort to turn reality inside out and to claim that the real problem is not the racism that is experienced by people of color, but alleged racism against whites, that somehow the real victims of racism, certainly since the civil rights era, are white people and not people of color, which is simply not the case, to say the least.
Yeah.
But it's becoming increasingly common. And actually, if you look at, polling, periodic polling, I mean, you see that this perception, this narrative of white people being the targets, the real targets of racism, that efforts at racial equality are anti-white. It's a sentiment that is growing. And it's at a place where now, media personalities, politicians are very explicit about this in their language. They've traded dog whistles for bullhorns at this point, and they're directly appealing and provoking white paranoia and aggression for political gain. I was actually thinking about this morning, and there are people who are commenting on social media, that the 2024 elections are starting to heat up. And some of us are making the observation that, distorting is going to be part of the political strategy. It's going to be part of the political playbook. People are going to make very blatant, very clear appeals to paranoia and aggression amongst some of the white population. Oh, it's very, very dangerous.
It's dangerous. It's depressing.
Yes. But if you see it, you can beat it.
Yep.
That's the good news about racism denial, is that if we can see it in action, we can respond to it. We can challenge it. We can have opportunities for people to learn, to grow, to shift perception. And that was part of my hope in kind of putting this out there for folks, is to give them a tool that they can use, because this is happening every day, all day. But people can do something about it.
Can we go into specifics about that? I mean, obviously, I know as we were going down the different tactics, one obvious thing is to just, call people on things, obviously. Mm-hmm. But what are some of the big picture things we can do to deal with this?
Yeah. So if you're talking about sort of your own interactions with people, and individually or in groups, one helpful thing to do is to just ask people what they think racism is.
Yeah.
Ask them to define their terms. So, for example, if someone is accusing you of being racist for trying to talk about racism, say, well, could you define racism for me?
A little explanation will help you.
Yeah. Like, I mean, what do you mean? And what specifically did I do that was racist and why? Because often people have very different notions of what we're talking about. So they're talking past each other. There's also a lot of disinformation and misinformation, miseducation about what racism is.
Yep.
And so that's always a good place to start, is just to slow people down and just ask them to explain what they're saying. Another thing, and it's deceptively simple, is just to provide people with accurate information.
Right. What a concept.
There are many people who genuinely do not know better in these moments.
Yeah.
I know people I know, people I love, people I respect, they engage in racism denial. Lots of people do it.
Yep.
And so sometimes just bringing it to their attention in the moment, they're like, oh, I really didn't think about it that way. Or even, I don't know why I said that. I don't know why I said that.
Yeah.
I don't know why I had that reaction.
Maybe just looking inward.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Particularly for the people for whom it's more of a coping mechanism.
Right.
I think if they can slow down and understand where that reaction is coming from, it gives them the opportunity to choose to respond in a different way. They don't have to keep engaging in denial. They can face reality with courage, and they can work with people who want to make it better, of which there are many people.
Yeah.
I think that the more difficult folks are the people for whom it's strategic.
Right.
Because they know what they're doing, and they have no intention of stopping. So what I've said to people is that the best you can do is to expose them.
Right.
Right. To expose them, to say, I see what you're doing. I know why you're doing it. and I'm not going to let you get away with it. And when you are able to do that publicly, even if that person is not yet willing to change their behavior, you might have an effect on other people that are watching that interaction.
Yeah, take away the power.
Yeah, and people say, oh, you know, that is what they're doing.
Yep.
That's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
And that's wrong, right? So, I mean, I try to do that a lot. I encourage people to do that a lot. Because as you said, I mean, it's the way that that folks kind of work in the shadows, so to speak. It's the sleight of hand that they engage in, that's where their power comes from. Because when they're exposed to the light, so to speak, it's much harder for them to get away with it and do what they're doing. And to use kind of a health metaphor, it can actually help to inoculate other people from their influence, right? Yeah. The more people who are able to see this for what it is, the harder it is for people to be manipulated and to be deceived. Because the people who are doing it strategically, they've been doing it for a long time.
That's right.
They're very good at it. And they're very good at making it appear that that's not what they're doing. You know, that they're engaging in some kind of good faith debate about ideas.
Right.
Or they're trying to challenge so-called wokeness. Or they're just engaging in quote-unquote free speech. Or, and we talked about this last time, they're just, you know, I'm just quoting facts and data. How can that be racist, right?
Yeah.
Or I'm just talking about the science. That's not racist, you know? And it's like, well, yeah, it is. Because of the way that you're doing it and your motivation for doing it. So I don't think people should minimize the power of just sheer exposure.
Yep.
It really is really, really important. And if you have the opportunity to not let it pass when it's happening, don't let it pass.
And that's not always easy, you know? I mean,
not at all. Not at all.
You know, like you were saying, you know, it could be someone close to you who has some crazy ideas. That's, you know, it's not always easy to call someone, but expose it to the light and it can be fixed or helped or something.
Yeah, and asking people to just explain what they're saying or why they're saying it. I mean, I've actually seen people talk themselves into a different point of view.
Yeah.
Because the more they talk and try to explain, the less sense it makes, or the less consistent it is with really who they feel that they are as a person. And they say, you know what, I don't even think I believe this anymore. Or this, you know, why am I saying these things? This isn't who I am. This isn't the kind of world that I want to live in.
Yep.
And it's like, well, yeah, so then stop. You don't have to do that. You can choose to approach this problem differently and become part of the solution, which is what we need more and more people to do. And if you make a problem harder to see, you make it harder to solve, which is what racism denial is really about.
Dr. Philippe Copeland is clinical associate professor at the Boston University School of Social Work, faculty lead in education and training at the BU Center for Anti-Racist Research, and faculty affiliate at the Center for Innovation in Social Science. I invite you to check out his amazing piece from the Boston Globe titled The Art of the Denial, How Racism Deniers Obscure the Reality of Racism, Minimizing Its Significance. Dr. Copeland, thank you for coming on again, helping us understand better what is obviously a critical and very complex issue. And like you said, the more we talk about it, the more maybe we can get closer to making some inroads. So I'm, as always, I'm grateful for your time, Dr. Copeland. Thank you.
Thank you.